United States v. Ryerson. Mr. Burgon?
May it please the Court, Marcus Burgon on behalf of Richard Ryerson. This case raises two issues. Both of the facts are interrelated. The first issue has to do with the District Court's denial of the motion to suppress the evidence seized from Richard Ryerson's home. The contention there is that the search was not authorized, that the third party giving consent to the search did not have either actual or apparent authority. The second point relates to the enhancement of two levels under 3C1.1 for obstruction for a phone call made by Richard Ryerson from the Adams County Jail to an employee instructing him to destroy the contraband firearm, which is the subject of the indictment.
And that's not obstruction of justice?
Well, in this case, Your Honor, as a general rule, perhaps one could say that could be obstruction. Well, on the facts of this case, Your Honor.
Perhaps someone tell him to destroy the evidence? That you regard as a perhaps obstruction of justice?
An obstruction of no moment in this case, as the phone call was recorded and, in fact, led the police to search the residence a second time.
Now, most obstructions fail. We know that, obviously. That's why these people are prosecuted. That's a loser.
Well, in this case, the attempt, I submit, is a very...
It doesn't matter what's successful or not. That's not what obstruction is.
As to the search issue, Your Honors, with every case involving the exceptions to the Fourth Amendment's warrant requirement, whether the police had could reasonably rely on that, on the party's consent is one of the circumstances, and the facts here amply suggest and amplify that there was no consent or authority on the part of Jennifer Lewicki. The claims of a...
So this caretaker, what was Kushme or something?
Crumscheid was the former employee who had a key.
So Crumscheid let the police in the second...
On the first occasion.
The police in, right?
On the first occasion, on February 9th.
Okay. So that was fine, right?
Well, the authority, though, to enter the residence was premised on the former co-inhabitant, his ex-wife, who had moved out.
Yeah, but Crumscheid had authority to let people into the house.
He had authority to make sure the house was being safe, and that is why he then called the police when he saw that there was a window broken and he suspected
a
burglary.
Right, and they come with her, right?
They interview her as a suspect in the burglary, obtain her consent.
When they went to the house, when Crumscheid was there, wasn't she with them?
She was, Your Honor.
And he admits the three of them, or whatever, however many.
Presents the key, they open the door.
Pardon?
He presents the key to the residence.
Yeah. Okay, so he invites them in effect, or he consents to their entry. So that's okay. Now, when they're in there, they see the scale, right?
Correct.
Well, when they see the scale, that surely corroborates the information she had given them.
It's about the only
if
piece
that's
of...
that's true, then they could easily have gotten a warrant.
Indeed. They could easily...
Well, but suppose... Well, why then isn't it an inevitable discovery case? That is, if they... Assuming that first entry, you know, where Crumscheid let them in, assuming that's lawful, then they see the scale, and that corroborates the information they've gotten from the girlfriend, ex-wife, and then they go and they find the gun. Okay. So that's fine. Now, suppose if they had been more scrupulous and they had known they had to get a warrant, they would have gotten a warrant. So what's the harm?
Well, the harm here, Your Honor, is the second search.
If they could have gotten a warrant, suppose we're certain that any judicial officer would have issued the warrant after they had corroborated the girlfriend's testimony by seeing the scale in the house. Suppose any magistrate would grant a warrant. Would issue a warrant, then what's the harm from their not having gotten a warrant?
I take a step back, Your Honor, and say that the police were there. So
no, I don't want to step back. I want you to answer my question. I'm assuming the initial entry is consented to and is lawful, and that they see the scale and that in plain view, which is fine, and that corroborates the information they got from the girlfriend, and now they have a corroborated informant, and if they went to a magistrate, they would get a warrant. So if that were the fact, you don't have to agree to it, just hypothetically. If that's correct up to that point, then I don't see what the harm is from their failure to get a warrant.
Had they done those steps, as Your Honor suggests, I would agree that it would be proper, the search would be proper, but those aren't necessarily the facts as they are developed in the record.
But if they are the facts, then you agree it's an inevitable discovery case.
With the exception that the record as developed in this case is mildly different, I would agree with Your Honor. Where I disagree, and where the record, I believe, disagrees, shows that, number one, they were erroneous in their belief that the third-party consent was legitimate. It was not reasonable on the facts based on this former cohabitant.
You go up to someone's house, and he opens the door or gives you the key or whatever he did. Well, he's the caretaker, gives you the key, says, fine, yeah, you can go in and look around.
Well, there's
What's wrong with that?
There's a dearth of evidence in the record with respect to Crumbscheid. The entire premise of the police's presence at the Ryerson home was the consent granted by Jennifer Lewicki.
No, I don't care. Look, the question is, we know why they went there, and they may have thought her consent was adequate, that she was living there or what have you. But the fact is, there's someone who is, in fact, has authority, that is authority given by his principal, the defendant, to admit people to the house, and he does so. So why isn't that the end of it, the end of the consent issue?
Well, I don't know that the record as developed in the district court doesn't show that even the third-party consent through Jason Crumbscheid is necessarily as strong as perhaps the court suggests.
What difference that? Suppose you came to my house, and in fact, there was a burglar in the house. I wasn't there. The burglar. And the burglar lets you in. You don't know who he is. He just lets you in. And you look around and find all sorts of incriminating stuff. Well, that would be perfectly proper, you know, apparent authority to let you in, and that would be consent, right?
Candidly, Your Honor, under the Fourth Amendment, I'm troubled by that scenario. I may be wrong, but I'm still troubled by that. I would want there to be more indicia of reliability and for an officer to be more reasonable in obtaining or searching that residence. The mere fact
you come up to the door and you say, do you mind if I search your residence? And the burglar says, no, fine, I have nothing to hide. He didn't tell you he's a burglar. He just says, fine, come in, look around. What more do you have to do? You have to ask him for identification or for a deed or something to show that he really owns the house?
Well, the facts, if I can analogize them a little bit here.
What do you think of that case?
Well, of your case, Your Honor, if the burglar comes to the door wearing a black outfit and a stocking cap, and I can...
No, he's a well-dressed burglar.
The diamond burglar of your scenario, Your Honor, presents a problem for me. I would want to know more information. I don't think enough is there for me to enter the residence. And I don't think that in this case, Jason Crumbscheid is that burglar.
The police operate, when they go up and ask someone for consent to search, they don't conduct an investigation of the person's authority. If the person looks as if, you know, lives there, or this guy has a key. Usually someone who has a key to your house can let you in. You don't live there anymore, and
well, this court,
person has the key, and he lets people in.
This court gave a good outline in Groves as to the ten factors, a non-exclusive list.
Not really, 10 factors, that is absurd. What on earth can a court do with 10 factors?
Well, it can begin
to... That's much, right?
Defense attorneys like factors.
10 factors, they have... you like 10 factors.
Yeah, I like 10 factors.
Of course, it's much. The 10 factors, since they have no weight... You can pick out one and say, that's the big factor.
And in fact, I'll do that with your scenario with the key. That is one of the 10 factors. But I don't think that Crumbscheid would qualify under any of the other 9. And so applying Groves to your fact scenario, I think that the police wouldn't have a reasonable basis for searching or relying on third-party consent to search the Ryerson home. I see that my time has expired.
Okay, well, thank you, Mr. Bergam. And we'll give you a little more time because I pestered you a lot. Ms. Dushman?
Good morning. May it please the Court. My name is Meredith Dushman, and I represent the United States. I want to just start out clarifying something related to Jason Crumbscheid. And I have to say that in fairness to the defendant, although the United States did point out several times during its brief that Jason Crumbscheid, when asked to open the door, did, and in fact did have a key that was given to him by Ryerson with instructions to watch the place, we never did make the specific argument that that was sufficient for purposes of consent. So in fairness to the defendant, that made
an inevitable discovery argument, did you?
You know, Your Honor, I made that argument below, but I did not make it on appeal. I made that argument below in response to the argument that, okay, so she had authority to give consent for the place, but not for the hidden compartment in the wall. And I made the argument, well, if she had authority to give everything, once the thermal imager came in and they saw the spot and they heard the phone call, they could have, you know, obviously gotten a warrant at that point. That argument was abandoned by the defendant on appeal, that specific scope of consent argument, and so I didn't raise the inevitable discovery argument. Perhaps I should have in hindsight, but I didn't.
So does your case turn on whether she had apparent authority to let the police in?
Your Honor, the district court found both actual and apparent, and I think that it's both.
Sounds odd. I mean, surely Ryerson had revoked that authority.
I don't think that he did. That's certainly the argument that he's making. He's saying that...
Well, hadn't he changed the locks?
That's an interesting fact, Your Honor. That is what she told the detectives that interviewed her prior to going in. She later changed her testimony under oath to say essentially she just simply locked herself out when she went to Chicago. What was actually true, we don't know for purposes of actual authority, but certainly for the analysis of apparent authority, that fact certainly does cut against the government because that was what she told them at the time, yes.
So it doesn't seem they had apparent authority, did they? Or what? Would she have a right? Do we know whether... So first she broke the window and went and collected all her belongings.
She didn't collect all her belongings, but...
Yes. Do we know that she had other stuff in there?
Yes. That is a fact that the defendant raises a number of times during his brief, and it's a point that I want to make. A number of times in the defendant's brief, he appears to disagree with the legal conclusions by the district court. But really, if you look closer at it, it's really more just disagreement as to certain findings of fact below. And one of the findings of fact below that's key is that Jennifer Lewicki still had belongings in the house on February 9th.
What were they? Do we know?
They were hers and her daughter's clothes. She testified very clearly that when she left on February 5th to go to her mother's house in Chicago, she took only an overnight bag with her. She did not take her belongings or her daughter's belongings. Now, it is true and a part of the record that on February 8th, when she went in to the home, she went in for the purpose of getting some of hers and her daughter's belongings and took, I believe the phrase was a van load or a truckload. Well, anyone with an infant child knows a truckload of kids' stuff isn't nearly enough to get everything out of there. She still had items belonging to both her and her daughter at the home when detectives went in on February 9th. That is a finding of fact made by the magistrate. And so, in addition to that finding of fact that you alluded to, there's a couple of other findings of fact here that I think are key. that the court specifically found, and the defendant really can't get around. One of them is that the investigator didn't engage in willful blindness by failing to read Ryerson's letter on February 9th, and that when officers conducted the first search on February 9th, what they saw confirmed the information that Jennifer Lewicki had given him about her ties to the house. So I think a lot of the defendant's arguments are really sort of couched as legal conclusions, but really what they are is they're an invitation for you to simply rewrite the facts, in a better version that the defendant likes better. So I do think there's actual authority. At a minimum here, however, there is apparent authority.
Did Judge Clavert just find that some clothes were left?
Pardon me?
Did Judge Clavert just make a finding that some clothes were left in the house? Is that the finding that you're suggesting is there?
I don't know that either the magistrate or the district court made some finding as to the quantity of it necessarily, just that there was stuff there.
Well, did she leave under a heavy whip? I mean, she broke in, took a truckload, you say?
When she left to go visit her mother in Chicago.
She took an overnight bag.
She took only an overnight bag.
Yeah, but you suggested a return, right?
Correct.
And then she broke the window.
Correct.
She broke the window, right?
Yes.
Okay, and then she, she needed to make, get her entry. Now, then she takes a substantially greater amount of time,
yes.
Right?
Yes. No doubt about that.
Yeah, and I suspect she wasn't going to linger there, right?
No, she was afraid to stay.
That's exactly right.
Yes.
So, but you say because there's some residual leavings of personal property, that means she had, she still had an interest in that?
I think that's part of it. I think that's part of it, Your Honor. I think that shows she hadn't moved out completely. But
well,
there's the
have,
other.
But that's my inquiry.
Right.
If she's left a few items. Unless we conclude that if you don't take every pot and pan and
right.
and pair of pants, that you've not left the property.
Certainly.
We don't know, though, do we?
We do not have an exact quantity, and no doubt it's a matter of degree. If there are items in every room, that's one thing. If you leave one document there or one item of clothing, that's... on the other side of the continuum. But the other aspect here is this business thing. Jennifer Lewicki owned 15% of the Dells Cab Company.
What did that amount to? She just, answered the phone?
Well, she, first of all, owned the business, partially, but
so
she also worked there.
Okay.
Yeah.
Was there one vehicle involved? What did the taxi business constitute?
The Dells Cab Company... I believe at that time, I don't think it's part of the record, but my recollection is that it was about two or three cabs.
And they could not be sold without her permission as a 15% owner? Do we know that? I'm just trying to get a sense of, she's entitled to 15% of whatever, if there are profits. But what does that tell us, that she's got this interest? And it just happens that they answer the phone at the house. I mean, it isn't exactly corporate headquarters, right?
I suppose to the extent that it's not IBM such that there's, all different types of businesses all over. It is only a one-location business, and that
was
location was clearly at the house. I don't know the answer to
what
that question.
What if it was a cell phone? And they both, she just answers a cell phone, and she could be
right.
At
it's
the
true. With a cell phone, she could be anywhere, but it's clear that she said she answered the phones at the kitchen table. That's where she dispatched the cabs. The records for the business were kept at the house. And she and Mr. Ryerson represented to the community at large that was their place of business and that they were co-owners. So,
What do you mean by represent? There were ads in papers or newspapers?
Well, the ads for the cab business do have that number that was called.
That's
that
the number,
she answered.
But not the address.
Well, but I think this is referenced actually in our brief. But for example, when they would get a cab license or however you want to say it, and they have to apply to the village of Lake Delton, it says, who's the property owner? Jennifer Lewicki and Richard Ryerson. Where is the business located? 911 Gillette Lane.
So he could have put armed guards, changed the locks, and as long as she has that 15% interest in this cab company, she would never abandon that property.
Boy, armed guards are... are stretched, but I don't mean to not answer your question, but it's, you know, everything is so fact specific. This is certainly a bizarre scenario, no doubt about it. I think under these...
Would there have been business records in the house?
There were business records in the house. That was part of the record.
Entitled to access to those.
Yes. There were business records in the house, and in fact, when they went in on February 9th to do the search, and she was telling them she had this interest in the business, she was able to go right away and locate the records and show the detectives, further corroborating, you know, generally her interest in the house, her connection to the house, but also her connection to the business.
And weren't those business and tax records for the cab company she supplied?
Yes. And they were located in the house. And she knew right where to look.
And one of those documents, was it this application for the license, was that in the house too, which showed both of their names on it with that address?
I don't think that that
was there.
Was in there, or at least that's not part of the record. That's something that I obtained after the fact.
Okay.
And moving, I see my red light is on. I don't know if you have any other questions.
Is there something essential that you'd like to say? If so,
Your Honor, I would simply be repeating my brief, so no.
Well, thank you very much, Ms. Leishman. And Mr. Bergen, your time expired. We'll give you a minute if you have something of note to say.
I would gladly answer any other questions the court has. Otherwise, I have no other points to make.
Okay, well, thank you very much. And you were appointed. And pardon?
Retained.
You're not. Well, we thank you anyway. And we thank Ms. Leishman. And the court will be in recess until 9:30 tomorrow.